The elections. The former Prime Minister, Mr. Wentworth Lane, was defeated in the recent elections. He is now retiring from political life and has gone abroad. My friend Crawley has always been a fanatical opponent of Mr. Lane's Radical Progressive Party. After the elections, Crawley went to the former Prime Minister's house. When he asked if Mr. Lane lived there, the policeman on duty told him that since his defeat, the ex-Prime Minister had gone abroad. On the following day, Crawley went to the house again. The same policeman was just walking slowly past the entrance when Crawley asked the same question. Though a little suspicious this time, the policeman gave him the same answer. The day after, Crawley went to the house once more and asked exactly the same question. This time, the policeman lost his temper. "I told you yesterday and the day before yesterday," he shouted. "Mr. Lane was defeated in the elections. He has retired from political life and gone to live abroad." "I know," answered Crawley, "but I love to hear you say it."
Passage 84. On strike. Busmen have decided to go on strike next week. The strike is due to begin on Tuesday. No one knows how long it will last. The busmen have stated that the strike will continue until general agreement is reached about pay and working conditions. Most people believe that the strike will last for at least a week. Many owners of private cars are going to offer free rides to people on their way to work. This will relieve pressure on the trains to some extent. Meanwhile, a number of university students have volunteered to drive buses while the strike lasts. All the young men are expert drivers, but before they drive any of the buses, they will have to pass a special test. The students are going to take the test in 2 days' time. Even so, people are going to find it difficult to get to work. But so far, the public has expressed its gratitude to the students in letters to the press. Only one or two people have objected that the students will drive too fast.
Passage 85. Never too old to learn. I have just received a letter from my old school informing me that my former headmaster, Mr. Reginald Page, will be retiring next week. Pupils of the school, old and new, will be sending him a present to mark the occasion. All those who have contributed towards the gift will sign their names in a large album which will be sent to the headmaster's home. We shall all remember Mr. Page for his patience and understanding, and for the kindly encouragement he gave us when we went so unwillingly to school. A great many former pupils will be attending a farewell dinner in his honor next Thursday. It is a curious coincidence that the day before his retirement, Mr. Page will have been teaching for a total of 40 years. After he has retired, he will devote himself to gardening. For him, this will be an entirely new hobby. But this does not matter, for, as he has often remarked, one is never too old to learn.
Passage 86. Out of control. As the man tried to swing the speedboat round, the steering wheel came away in his hands. He waved desperately to his companion, who had been water skiing for the last 15 minutes. Both men had hardly had time to realize what was happening when they were thrown violently into the sea. The speedboat had struck a buoy, but it continued to move very quickly across the water. Both men had just begun to swim towards the shore when they noticed with dismay that the speedboat was moving in a circle. It now came straight towards them at a tremendous speed. In less than a minute, it roared past them only a few feet away. After it had passed, they swam on as quickly as they could, because they knew that the boat would soon return. They had just had enough time to swim out of danger when the boat again completed a circle. On this occasion, however, it had slowed down considerably. The petrol had nearly all been used up. Before long, the noise dropped completely, and the boat began to drift gently across the water.
Passage 87. A perfect alibi. At the time the murder was committed, I was travelling on the 8 o'clock train to London, said the man. Do you always catch such an early train? Asked the inspector. Of course I do, answered the man. I must be at work at 10 o'clock. My employer will confirm that I was there on time. Would a later train get you to work on time? Asked the inspector. I suppose it would, but I never catch a later train. At what time did you arrive at the station? At 7:50. I bought a paper and waited for the train. And you didn't notice anything unusual? Of course not. I suggest, said the inspector, that you are not telling the truth. I suggest that you did not catch the 8 o'clock train, but that you caught the 8:25, which would still get you to work on time. You see, on the morning of the murder, the 8 o'clock train did not run at all. It broke down at Ferngreen Station and was taken off the line.
Passage 88. Trapped in a mine. Six men have been trapped in a mine for 17 hours. If they are not brought to the surface soon, they may lose their lives. However, rescue operations are proving difficult. If explosives are used, vibrations will cause the roof of the mine to collapse. Rescue workers are therefore drilling a hole on the north side of the mine. They intend to bring the men up in a special capsule. If there had not been a hard layer of rock beneath the soil, they would have completed the job in a few hours. As it is, they have been drilling for 16 hours, and they still have a long way to go. Meanwhile, a microphone, which was lowered into the mine 2 hours ago, has enabled the men to keep in touch with their closest relatives. Though they are running out of food and drink, the men are cheerful and confident that they will get out soon. They have been told that rescue operations are progressing smoothly. If they knew how difficult it was to drill through the hard rock, they would lose heart. Passage 89. A slip of the tongue. People will do anything to see a free show, even if it is a bad one. When the news got round that a variety show would be presented at our local cinema by the P&U Birdseed Company, we all rushed to see it. We had to queue for hours to get in, and there must have been several hundred people present just before the show began. Unfortunately, the show was one of the dullest we have ever seen. Those who failed to get in need not have felt disappointed, as many of the artists who should have appeared did not come. The only funny things we heard that evening came from the advertiser at the beginning of the program. He was obviously very nervous, and for some minutes stood awkwardly before the microphone. As soon as he opened his mouth, everyone burst out laughing. We all know what the poor man should have said, but what he actually said was, "This is the Pooh and E. Seedbird Company. Good ladies, evening and gentlemen."
Passage 90. Brasilia. Though Brazil is one of the richest countries in the world, much of it has not yet been developed. It was mainly for this reason that the Brazilian government decided to have a new city built 600 miles northwest of Rio de Janeiro. Designed by the great architect Lúcio Costa, the new city, Brasilia, replaced Rio de Janeiro as the capital of Brazil in 1960. Brasilia has been carefully planned for modern living. Its wide roads, which can take 14 lanes of traffic, have been kept away from living areas. Children do not have to cross busy streets to go to school. Housewives can visit shopping centers on foot, for in these specially designed living areas, cars are unnecessary. At first, the government had great difficulty in persuading people to leave Rio and to settle in Brasilia. Since 1960, however, the population has been growing all the time. Brasilia has quickly established itself as the capital of the country. The idea to have the capital moved so far inland will have a great effect on the future of Brazil.
Passage 91. Three men in a basket. A pilot noticed a balloon which seemed to be making for a Royal Air Force station nearby. He informed the station at once, but no one there was able to explain the mystery. The officer in the control tower was very angry when he heard the news, because balloons can be a great danger to aircraft. He said that someone might be spying on the station, and the pilot was ordered to keep track of the strange object. The pilot managed to circle the balloon for some time. He could make out three men in a basket under it, and one of them was holding field glasses. When the balloon was over the station, the pilot saw one of the men taking photographs. Soon afterwards, the balloon began to descend, and it landed near an airfield. The police were called in, but they could not arrest anyone, for the basket contained two members of parliament and the commanding officer of the station. As the commanding officer explained later, one half of the station did not know what the other half was doing.
Passage 92. Asking for trouble. It must have been about 2 in the morning when I returned home. I tried to wake up my wife by ringing the doorbell, but she was fast asleep, so I got a ladder from the shed in the garden, put it against the wall, and began climbing towards the bedroom window. I was almost there when a sarcastic voice below said, "I don't think the windows need cleaning at this time of the night." I looked down and nearly fell off the ladder when I saw a policeman. I immediately regretted answering in the way I did, but I said, "I enjoy cleaning windows at night." "So do I," answered the policeman in the same tone. "Excuse my interrupting you. I hate to interrupt a man when he's busy working, but would you mind coming with me to the station?" "Well, I'd prefer to stay here," I said. "You see, I've forgotten my key." "Your what?" he called. "My key," I shouted. Fortunately, the shouting woke up my wife, who opened the window just as the policeman had started to climb towards me.
Passage 93. a noble gift. One of the most famous monuments in the world, the Statue of Liberty, was presented to the United States of America in the 19th century by the people of France. The great statue, which was designed by the sculptor Auguste Bartholdi, took 10 years to complete. The actual figure was made of copper, supported by a metal framework which had been especially constructed by Eiffel. Before it could be transported to the United States, a site had to be found for it, and a pedestal had to be built. The site chosen was an island at the entrance of New York Harbor. By 1884, a statue which was 151 feet tall had been erected in Paris. The following year, it was taken to pieces and sent to America. By the end of October 1886, the statue had been put together again, and it was officially presented to the American people by Bartholdi. Ever since then, the great monument has been a symbol of liberty for the millions of people who have passed through New York Harbor to make their homes in America.
Passage 94. Future Champions. Experiments have proved that children can be instructed in swimming at a very early age. At a special swimming pool in Los Angeles, children become expert at holding their breath underwater even before they can walk. Babies of 2 months old do not appear to be reluctant to enter the water. It is not long before they are so accustomed to swimming that they can pick up weights from the floor of the pool. A game that is very popular with these young swimmers is the underwater tricycle race. Tricycles are lined up on the floor of the pool, 7 feet underwater. The children compete against each other to reach the other end of the pool. Many pedal their tricycles, but most of them prefer to push or drag them. Some children can cover the whole length of the pool without coming up for breath even once. Whether they will ever become future Olympic champions, only time will tell. Meanwhile, they should encourage those among us who cannot swim 5 yards before they are gasping for air.
Passage 95. A Fantasy. When the ambassador of Escalopia returned home for lunch, his wife got a shock. He looked pale, and his clothes were in a frightful state. "What has happened?" she asked. "How did your clothes get into such a mess?" "A fire extinguisher, my dear," answered the ambassador dryly. "University students set the embassy on fire this morning." "Good heavens!" exclaimed his wife. "And where were you at the time?" "I was in my office, as usual," answered the ambassador. "The fire broke out in the basement. I went down immediately, of course, and that fool Horst aimed a fire extinguisher at me. He thought I was on fire. I must definitely get that fellow posted." The ambassador's wife went on asking questions, when she suddenly noticed a big hole in her husband's hat. "And how can you explain that?" she asked. "Oh, that," said the ambassador. "Someone fired a shot through my office window. Accurate, don't you think? Fortunately, I wasn't wearing it at the time. If I had been, I would not have been able to get home for lunch."
Passage 96. The Dead Return. A festival for the dead is held once a year in Japan. This festival is a cheerful occasion, for on this day, the dead are said to return to their homes, and they are welcomed by the living. As they are expected to be hungry after their long journey, food is laid out for them. Specially made lanterns are hung outside each house to help the dead to find their way. All night long, people dance and sing. In the early morning, the food that had been laid out for the dead is thrown into a river or into the sea, as it is considered unlucky for anyone living to eat it. In towns that are near the sea, the tiny lanterns, which had been hung in the streets the night before, are placed into the water when the festival is over. Thousands of lanterns slowly drift out to sea, guiding the dead on their return journey to the other world. This is a moving spectacle, for crowds of people stand on the shore watching the lanterns drifting away until they can be seen no more.